I'm down today. Really down. It's all just starting to get to me. COVID, my kids stuck at home in front of their computers, the upcoming election and all the cruelty, businesses failing, California on fire, climate change. It's just a lot. And here's the thing. I work to remind myself that as a guy who writes for a living, it's okay to have off days in these shitty times. And I hope you guys listening remember that too. If the words just aren't flowing, take a walk or a bike ride. Watch Ghostbusters 2. Bake a cake. Take a nap. Writing isn't one of those things where it always comes smoothly. I've been doing this for decades, and I still encounter the same roadblocks, the same stumbles, the same challenges. So if you're feeling like I feel today, don't beat yourself up. Your laptop will be there tomorrow. My name is Jeff Perlman, and I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 9 books, as well as the host of Two Writers Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. Today's episode features Judy Batista, the terrific NFL.com columnist and former New York Times NFL scribe. This is episode number 172. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, being quarantined sucks, and so does your podcast.
All right, Judy, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
I just warned you before we started recording that I was setting you up and I was going to lead you into something. And here's what I want to say. Whenever I do this podcast, I always try to find the oldest byline or article I can find by a guest. God. Yours, however, is not a byline. Yours is a name appearing in a Miami Herald story, 1986, with the headline Freshman Fats. And it's about
oh my God.
Students gaining freshman 15
at the University of
Miami.
Oh my God.
Quote from Judy Batista. It was always the snack machines that got me. Ring-dings. Everyone puts on weight. If they say they're not, they're lying. And that's Judy Batista's debut, as far as I can tell.
I did not even know that. I don't remember that at all. But the snack machines were really good.
And that's when it all began. That's when the career in media.
That's my journalism career in a nutshell. The snack machines got me.
I thought you would at least enjoy that. So,
awesome.
Yeah, no charge. So, actually, though, the first byline I found by you dates back to August 23rd, 1990. Mm-hmm. Park improvements to make splash with boaters.
Man.
And they, in the Miami Herald, a special Miami Herald, your lead at the time was, the dog days of summer simmer on. But Coconut Creek boating enthusiasts will soon have something new to make their cold water excursions more enjoyable.
Yikes.
You're cringing a little bit.
Yeah, so my first job was, like at the time, the Miami Herald had something called the Neighbors section, which was like, you know, they're sort of micro local. This is when newspapers, of course, were flush and had lots of advertisers who wanted to advertise. And so they had these micro local sections called Neighbors. And I wrote for Neighbors in Broward County. So like, you know, the suburbs of Fort Lauderdale, which Coconut Creek is one of them. And that's how I started. And that's how like a ton of people started in the business. Like, you know, Alex Marvez wrote for Neighbors too. Like a bunch of us did. And it was actually a great experience because you just covered everything. Like they would just throw you on like, Judy, go cover Pompano Beach. And you'd be like, you know, you're 22 years old. Okay. And all of a sudden you're going to city council meetings and it what it really taught me how to do is realize what's important to your readership. Like a lot of people in those areas are retirees on fixed income. And so every year, like when Pompano Beach would set the water rates, as crazy as this sounds, like that was a huge deal because what people were going to pay for their monthly water bill was really important if you're on a fixed income. And so that job, as crazy as it sounds, you know, those micro local things like really taught me to always sort of think about like, who am I writing for? Like who are you reporting this for? It was a great experience because you were responsible for basically filling the entire section. So you had to go out and dig up stories.
When you're a 20, 21 year old Judy Batista and you're there and you're writing these stories, did you have any inkling of what you wanted your career to become?
Nothing that bore any resemblance to what it has become. Like that question in job interviews always like sort of made me laugh. Like when I interviewed at the New York Times, I remember Bill Keller, former editor of the paper, asked me like, where do you see yourself in whatever it was, 5 or 10 years? And I was just like, I don't know. I haven't plotted it out like that. I thought I would be a news reporter when I studied journalism and then first went into journalism, I thought I would be a news reporter. I'm a news junkie, still a news junkie, you know, love news, follow politics closely and read a lot. So I thought I'd be a news reporter. I always loved sports. I was always a sports fan. Always read the sports section, like, you know, really passionate sports fan. And I sort of became a sports writer by accident. Like, it's not one of those stories of like, you know, I grew up from the time I was six, I wanted to cover the Mets. Like, it just wasn't like that. The way I became a sports reporter was like, when you're a young reporter at the Miami Herald, obviously you often work weekend shifts and weird times, just like most young reporters do. And the sports department at the Fort Lauderdale Bureau was next to the news desk. And so, you know, you'd be there on a Saturday. And of course, there'd be college football on and whatever other sports were on. And so while you're working, while you're, you know, making your cops checks, you know, you're talking to the sports department, the sports editors about the college football game that's going on. And so Sherry Johnson was the assistant sports editor. I've lost track of her. I don't know where she is now, but she was the assistant sports editor in the Fort Lauderdale Bureau. And she asked me one day, like, would you ever want to go cover sports, you know, cover anything? And so it just sort of started that way. Like, I covered, you know, like high school football, just like a lot of people do. And it just sort of happened that way. And they eventually had an opening in sports and said, you know, would you think about it? And that's how it started.
I was listening briefly to a podcast interview you did late last year, and you were talking about sort of the way you're judged as a woman heading into a sporting event, that certain people still cast these judgments on you and cast these aspersions on you and assume you're just not going to know. Like, she's not going to know, or she's not going to know, or blah, blah, blah. And I wonder, when you were first sort of dipping your toe into sports, I guess number one, did you feel that? And number two, how does a young woman ignore that or push it aside or not let it burden her?
I don't know if I was aware of it at the very beginning, because the very first sports assignments I did were like community sports. I mean, that's sort of what ran in those neighbor sections, was like, you know, high school sports and community sports. And for the most part, they are so happy to have anybody covering them that, like, you know, a Martian could show up to cover and they'd be like, yeah, come on in. So they don't care. I certainly never felt it at the Miami Herald in the newsroom, because they had an incredibly diverse staff. Paul Anger was the sports editor then, and they had, it was incredible. There were lots of women in the department. There were minorities. It was like, when I think about it now, how far ahead the Miami Herald was all the way back then from where newsrooms are even today, it's remarkable. So I certainly always felt like supported at work. That never even crossed my mind. And then, you know, my first big beat was the University of Miami football, which was bonkers. They were great at the time and a lot of fun and had incredible characters. The Rock was on that team.
Dennis Erickson was a coach at that point.
Dennis Erickson, and he always treated me really well. The players treated me well. The sports information directors treated me well, probably because they knew I had gone there. You know, that probably helped me a little bit. And I always thought it was important. The athletic director there at the time was named Paul D. He passed away a few years ago, unfortunately. And he was incredibly supportive of me. And he made it clear to me that if I ever had a problem, I was to come straight to him, that, you know, that it would not be tolerated. And I know that, you know, he like would tell people in the athletic department, like, there better not be a problem. Like, first of all, she's from the Miami Herald. Don't create a problem with the Miami Herald if you're the Miami Hurricanes. But also, like, there better just not, this better not be an issue here. So I never had that issue there, remarkably, never had that issue there. And I think, you know, after that, I was sort of established enough that I've been very fortunate that I have not had some of the like awful stories you hear have not happened to me. I've always been very lucky. There have always been other women on the staffs that I was working at. I was never the only woman. I was never the first. And I've always had really supportive male colleagues too, which I think is really important.
Does it ever become, like, the answer for me is no, so I don't know what it is for you. Like, does the locker room ever become comfortable?
No, and anybody who tells you it does is crazy. No, of course not. First of all, it's jammed, right? I mean, it's just crowded. It's sweaty. Most people are frantic, like after a game, right? You're just racing around trying to get information and get to people and get out of there so you can write. But it's not comfortable. I mean, you know that you're in their space and they just want to take a shower and get dressed and they've got to stand there and talk to you. I mean, it's just a ridiculous setup. Having said that, it's really necessary to do the job. Like, I can't imagine how they could construct anything similar. And we're sort of seeing that right now, you know, where everything is being done by Zoom calls. I mean, obviously we're not going to be anywhere near a locker room this season. You know, it's just very formal, and you certainly, it's very hard to talk to people alone. Like, you have to, you know, set up things on your own or hope that the team will help you. You know, it's, the locker room serves its purpose. Like, it really does. It's very efficient. But the idea that anybody wants to be in there, no, of course not. And I covered baseball briefly, and that's the ultimate example, because you're in there for 3 hours, you know, before a game, which is just awful. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. So much of that time is just wasted. You know, it's uncomfortable. And I don't think that's a woman issue. I mean, I think, like you said, I think men are uncomfortable in it too.
I remember when I was a baseball writer, and the Miami Florida Marlins had a third baseman named Wes Helms, who went out of his way to fart in the face of a reporter. And I just thought, that screams Major League Clubhouse more than any moment I've ever seen about.
Exactly.
No. Wait, I actually like the micro of this kind of thing, though. Like, because I do get a fair number of young reporters listening to this and writers and coming up. What is the best way to maximize Clubhouse time? What is the best way to use it? What is the best way to not come off as an asshole or an interloper or violating something that you don't want to violate?
Well, I think you probably have to go in with a plan, right? Like, you can't just show up in the locker room or the clubhouse and hope something happens. Like, you got to go in there with an idea of, well, this is maybe something I want to write about today, or I should talk to this guy. And then, you know, you have to be respectful. I mean, I think you also have to sort of read the signals. You know, if people are... I've noticed are really good at conveying if they really do not want to be bothered at that moment. Most guys are pretty good, but obviously people have bad days. We all do. And they will make it very clear. And then you've just got to read the room. But I think, you know, to me, if I were a player, what would drive me crazy would be people just sort of standing around doing nothing, you know, and sometimes that's how it is, because there's nobody in the locker room that you need, but, like, you know, just talk to people. You know, those are, I always find that, like, they're really good for just, hey, how you doing? You know, how's your kids, are okay? Like, are they good? Okay. It doesn't have to be a long thing, but I would emphasize, like, don't just go in there, like, and then just stand there and hope, you know, something falls on your head. Like, you got to go in with some idea of what you want to talk to people about.
There's nothing worse, nothing worse than the stand. When you're standing there, you know, you're pretending you're writing something, but you're not. I wish I could take everyone listening to this and put them there for 8 minutes just to understand.
It's brutal. And it happens so much because, let's face it, players get really good at knowing when the reporters are in there. And if they really don't want to be bothered, like, they'll stay in the player's lounge or, you know, stay in some room we have no access to. And so then the poor guys who are in the locker room, you know, are there. And then you've got, you know, a dozen reporters who are basically just standing there. Like, that happens all the time, especially in the NFL, where, you know, time is sort of constrained. You know, you've got a 45-minute window, and so everybody's in the locker room. A lot of players are not, because they know that that's the media time. And so the poor, you know, four guys who are in the locker room are just, you know, they're cannon fodder.
So is it possible for you to get a one-on-one interview in an NFL locker room, is that even a thing?
Yeah, you can, but you've really got to, first of all, you have to be really good with your timing. And then I think then the reporter has to sort of send off the signal, like, to the other reporters, like, I'm doing this by myself. Like,
wait. How do you do that?
You turn your back to the room. I think most reporters are pretty respectful of, like, they know if you're there and if you need. I did it once during the playoffs a few years ago when Danny Amendola was at the Patriots. And the question was, you know, was he going to come back? Nobody knew the answer. And I was doing the feature about him during that playoff week, and I needed him. Like, he literally hadn't been available all week, you know, like, I had to. And so I let the locals go at him first. That's only fair. I'm the visiting reporter from New York. Like, it's only fair that the locals get their shot at him. But then when the locals were done, I made a beeline for him, and I, you know, sort of turned my back and made it very clear, like, I needed to get two questions in, and, you know, and did. And that's, you got to do it. It's possible, but it's really hard, because again, I think teams have gotten so sophisticated at knowing, like, everybody needs, you know, I'm just using this as an example. Everybody needs Rob Gronkowski. And so, you know, Gronk is going to walk into the locker room with 4 minutes left. So if you hoped to get one question in to Gronk by yourself, I mean, there's just no way that's going to happen.
You have Danny Amendola for those, whatever, minute and a half, and you have your back, and some TV guy comes up and puts his mic in. Are you allowed to say?
Yeah, I definitely, in that circumstance, I think I would say, like, can you give us a minute, you know? And there, again, I think I've never had an incident where that was an issue. I think most people are really respectful of it because they know it happens to them, right? I mean, everybody has a point where you need somebody, you know, exclusively. And so I think people are pretty respectful. But yeah, it's fair, you know, it's fair to say. Having said that, again, like, I try very hard. If I'm the visiting reporter, I try very hard to let the locals go first, because, you know, they're the ones who are there every day and who need to write multiple stories. And so I try to let them go first.
My favorite moment, it used to happen a lot, is you'd be in the clubhouse after a game. You get a one-on-one with someone. It's like the Brewers second baseman. They'll be like, I'll tell you, when my mom died of cancer, it just ripped my heart out. Blah, 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 gives you this answer. And then my mom started crying, blah, blah, and some guy with the TV mic comes in and goes, hey, real quick, Danny, can you just talk about that hit in the third? And you just want to punch that person in the esophagus.
Right. We see it in news reports too, right? Like any kind of press conference setting where there's no continuity of thought. There's like everybody just has to get their random question in. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that happens, and especially when you've got, you know, time where people are asking those sort of feature kind of questions, and you get somebody talking about, you know, something personal, and then, yeah, you're just like, hey, could you talk about that play at the plate? But that I see more and more because, again, I think teams have gotten really sophisticated, and they make most availabilities now group availabilities, like to prevent the sort of one-on-one thing, unless it's prearranged. And so everybody's at the podium and there's just no continuity. You know, very rarely do you see one reporter follow up on something that a reporter just said, you know, a reporter just asked. I mean, you see it in if you watch White House briefings all the time, it's hard because everybody goes in with the question that they want asked or the question that their bosses want asked or whatever it is. And so there's just no continuity. There's no follow up. And that happens in sports too.
But do you think any of that is, the inexperience of reporters, meaning like, I remember being a younger reporter and you're like, okay, I'm going to ask this question. And then maybe you're sitting in a press conference. It's a really fascinating press conference, but you have this question in your head and you've convinced yourself that you need to ask this. Don't you think as you get older and as you do this more, you sort of understand the flow of it all?
You definitely understand the flow, and you know that, like, you should not interrupt a train of, if a player is talking about like some sort of deeply emotional moment, you probably should not interject with like, you know, how'd you learn to play shortstop like that? Who was your alert, right? Like, you've got to, again, read the room. And I do think that comes with experience that you wait or you tell the PR person, like, I'll ask my question later. It's, you know, don't come to me first, that kind of thing.
I just find, it's interesting we talk about, I just find like the Trump press conference is really fascinating where Trump will be like, I'm not talking to you. You're fake news. Get out of here. You suck. It's such a moment, right? Such a moment. And then the next person will be like, yeah, quick question about the trade deal with China. And, you know, like, I know the trade deal with China is important, but you just passed up something really, it drives me crazy. It just drives
me crazy. Yeah. I mean, I think I can only imagine that the pressure on the White House reporters is so excruciating, and it's such a bonkers atmosphere that you must just be like, I got to get my question in. I mean, like, we just got to get a question in here. I don't envy their job, that's for sure.
So we're both around the same age. We've both been doing this a long time. If you look back at your career, and maybe you just never had this, but was there a point when interviewing athletes or approaching athletes or dealing with athletes stopped being intimidating? Were you stopped being maybe hesitant at all to approach someone or nervous about approaching someone? Or did you never have that?
I've only had it with a rare few people. Like, you know, I had to approach Michael Jordan in a locker room once. And I mean, it's Michael Jordan. It was Michael Jordan at the height of his, you know, fame and awesomeness. And so that was more like, oh my God.
Wait, do you remember the actual like circumstance?
I don't remember the circumstance. I remember he was sitting at his locker and he was great. Yeah, like he was totally cool and friendly and answered the question. And it had nothing to do with him. It was like, oh my God, it's Michael Jordan. And then the only other people I've ever gotten, like, I think nervous talking to was, you know, I grew up in South Florida when the Miami Dolphins were the only thing there that mattered. And so the first time I ever talked to Don Shula, who again was lovely and helpful and warm, but the first time I talked to Don Shula was like, holy cow, it's Don Shula. Like, but otherwise, no, I've never been, I sort of have always felt that like, your job gives you an excuse to ask all these questions, right? Things you would never, you know, and again, maybe sort of personal probing questions that you'd never ask in real life. But your job gives you a shield. It was the only time, the other time I think I was nervous interviewing people was when I was in news at the Miami Herald. There was what was at the time a famous case of this suburban woman who was actually running sort of like a prostitution ring. And there were all of these sort of local people who were in her book. And, you know, the Miami Herald got the book and, you know, it was filled with like local doctors and lawyers. And so they sent out, you know, they fanned out all of these reporters to like go knock on their doors and try to get them. And I remember it was Halloween and I went to a home, and knocked on the door. And I mean, that, you know, you're just like, oh, this is going to be bad. You know, right? The subject's brutal. They know what's coming. And, you know, I knocked on the door and I remember the guy said to me, how dare you come to my house? Like, you know, and I was like, you're taking the moral high ground? Like, really? Like, I'm not the one who's in the book. But, you know, I was nervous doing that, obviously, because it's just such an incredibly uncomfortable experience.
I was going to say, I have a book coming out in a few weeks about the Shaq Kobe Lakers. And mm-hmm. one of the players on that team was J.R. Ryder. And I had an address for him and not a phone number. And I was going to be in Arizona. This is like last year. So I just got to knock on his door. So I knock on this door in suburban, wherever. Kid answers, I'm looking for J.R. Ryder. He goes back, woman comes, looking for J.R. Ryder. J.R. Ryder comes to the door.
Oh my God.
And he goes, bro, what are you just knock on my, bro, what are you doing? You just knock on my door. And I have a copy of another book I wrote. And I'm like, well, I wrote this book and blah, blah. Bro, that is so not, bro, you, and he kind of gets up in my face. And I'm pretty convinced he's about to hit me. And then he goes, wait, so what are you writing about? And I go, oh, Shaq, Kobe, Lakers. He goes, yeah, I'll talk to you. What do you want to know? And I was like, oh, this is amazing. I kind of love the energy of knocking on doors. Like, it's terrifying. It's like being in a really bad turbulence. It's like being in a really bad turbulence.
Terrifying. I'm trying to remember the another time I had to do it when I was covering sports because some story was coming and like I had to go try to get reaction. And of course, the person wasn't answering the phone because of course they knew we were trying to find them. And we had the address, you know, the research department dug up the address and I had to go knock on that person's door. And I remember being so relieved when they did not answer the door.
Oh yeah.
Oh, thank God. Okay. I tried. Goodbye. Right. But yeah, that's an uncomfortable experience, you know, but that's the only thing I've ever been nervous. Like, I don't think I was ever really nervous talking to athletes.
You got me beat on that one.
Before we continue at Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, who has something to say.
Hi, I'm Casey Perlman. And when I drink, I really drink. And my choice in whiskey brands is Old Crow. Smooth going down, warms the innards, and gets me super drunk in about 8 seconds. Old Crow, the official get yourself wasted choice of Two Writers Slinging.
Hey, wait, whoa, whoa. What the heck? This is an ad for 503 Sports, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. Hats, t-shirts, sweatshirts, jerseys, all at 503-sports.com.
Dad, seriously, this pandemic is going on for another 6 years. I haven't left the house since March. Can an underage high school senior just have her whiskey?
I feel like I've really failed as a father. First time I knew you existed is, true story, 1999, I'm covering baseball at Sports Illustrated. And I have this vivid memory because I was covering the Mets-Braves series.
Oh, God. Every game was rain delayed and went to extra innings. That's what I remember about that Mets season that I covered them that year. Every game.
I wrote a lot about the Mets that year, so maybe I just happened to see you at some games. And, you know, you're always kind of aware of who the local newspaper people are and blah, blah, blah. Probably didn't say a word to you all year. You are not a baseball writer. This is not your sport. You covered it for 1 year, right?
I covered it for half a season. They were making a change on the beat. They needed somebody to sort of fill in after the trade deadline even. So they needed somebody to do it. And then I already knew I was going to go on to the Jets beat the next year because the Jets writer was retiring. So they basically said, like, you know, will you go cover the Mets for however many months it was, you know? And of course, then the Mets go on this ridiculous run, right? They go all the way to the NLCS and suddenly you're covering the supernova. And it's just like, oh my God. And again, I remember every one of those games was like, felt like 14 innings. Like I would be on the phone with the sports editor and being like, I really need a sport with a clock. Like this is, and I love baseball. Like I'm a baseball fan, but covering it was just like, oh my God, you know, endless, endless.
Did you like covering that team?
I did like covering that team. It was a lot of fun. Bobby Valentine is just a hoot. You know, there was one game, I don't remember when it was, but there was one game where we're sitting in the manager's office after the game. So whatever time that is, you know, midnight, you know, you're just trying to get information and then get back up to the box to write. And they had lost. And Bobby just comes out with, yeah, the Wilpons should just fire me. And you're just like, again, midnight. And you're just like, like, what? But he was a blast to cover, and they had a lot of really good players. Like Al Leiter was on that team, Ventura, you know, Piazza, obviously. I mean, that was a very good team.
Whenever I hear people criticize Bobby Valentine about anything, I'm always like, all you had to do was cover the guy. The guy was the best.
Tremendous.
He was smart. He was well-spoken. He knew what your job was.
Yes, and he appreciated it. He understood exactly the role of the media. And he liked that you were there. He knew that, you know, you served a purpose. He was great to cover and incredibly quotable. Like, I mean, you could ask him about anything, very smart, as you said. You could ask him about anything and, you know, and he could talk about it. And it was a blast. Having said that, at the end of the season, they asked me, like, do you want to stay on the Mets instead of going to the Jets? And I was like, no, I want to go cover football. It's fun.
Is it easier to cover an NFL team than a Major League Baseball team?
It's just easier from a personal standpoint, I think. I mean, the baseball season is endless. It's so long. The travel is so much. You know, you're at spring training for 6 weeks before the season even starts. You're away. And so, you know, just from that point of view, yes, I think it's easier. And there's much better access in baseball. That's always been the case, and it's still the case. NFL access is much more regimented, so you have to work harder to get anything unusual. But I think it's just still much, much easier to cover the NFL, much easier to cover an NFL team because you're just not – first of all, the season takes on a rhythm in the NFL, right? It's, you know, Tuesday is the off day for players, and so you're not at the team. And then, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you travel on a Saturday to the wherever the game is. You know, Sunday, you've got – like there's a real rhythm to the season it takes on. And, I liked that. And I love football. I mean, I love the game.
I always ask writers this, like if you're the Jet beat writer, does it matter if Sam Darnold knows who you are? Does it matter if these guys know your name and see you walking by and say, oh, that's so-and-so, oh, that's so-and-so? Does that matter?
My experience on the beat when I was on the Jets and when I was on the Hurricanes and the Mets, for that matter, was it does help that they know you. First of all, they are much more comfortable talking to you on the record or off. They're much more likely to trust you to tell you stuff. And I'm not talking about bad stuff. They're much more likely to be candid with you. And I always thought training camp was the most important part of the season for that, which is why this year, with all of the restrictions where you're never talking to anybody in person at training camp, is really a shame because that's when you build the relationships. You know, training camp, right, used to be 2 a days. Like you'd be out there for 14 hours a day. They'd see you out there. They knew you were there. They knew you were paying attention to them. And that's, there was sort of like this sort of strange bond that you formed, like these days are endless. And here's another one. We're in day 10 of training camp and we're back here. And like, I thought that really helped you build relationships. First of all, because training camp you had to come up with different stories, right? I mean, you just can't write about the quarterback every day for 4 weeks. And so it forced you to write about the, you know, right guard who, you know, studied microbiology at Yale. And, you know, what the heck is he doing playing right guard? That helps you build those relationships. And I thought training camp was the most important part of the season for that, so that they know you.
Is it a real relationship?
No.
I'm covering the Jets, and I build a relationship with Lamont Jordan. I'm throwing back a name there for you.
Jordan, wow.
No charge for that. I'm covering Lamont Jordan, and I'm Judy Batista. And I know where he went to college, and I know his girlfriend's name, and I know his stats, and I know all that stuff. And he knows maybe your name is Judy Batista. Like, what does it actually mean to build a relationship with an athlete?
Yeah, no. I mean, does it mean that we really know them? Of course not. Like, no. And no. In the same way as if you were covering a politician, even as much as you cover them, do you really know these people? No. But I do think there is a comfort level that you get where they trust you and you trust them. And, you know, you, in some ways, you know, if they say, like, please don't write this, like, you know, if they know you and they've got a store of goodwill built up, like you see it all the time, like reporters will help players out. I've told players this in the past, like it helps the player to have a good relationship with the reporter because you get a much longer leash if something goes wrong, if the media likes you. That's just the reality of the situation. And you see that in every sport and you see it in every market is, if you are likable and you treat people well, it's harder for reporters to just crush you when something goes wrong because you have a personal affection for them. It's just the reality of the situation. So I, you know, when players say they can't stand the media, I'm like, you should, you know, it would help you to extend an olive branch because you're going to need them at some point.
It's very interesting. I've talked about this a lot and I've thought about this a lot. I wrote a book about Barry Bonds and I covered a lot of Barry Bonds. He could not have been a bigger dick to the media. Like it would be impossible and to people. And there was a story about him a few months ago in The Athletic, how he feels like baseball is treating him like a pariah and nobody is extending him an olive branch. And I always think like it is the classic, if you want an example to put on a platter for every player, why you should be nice to people. Here it is, because it actually matters.
I covered Herm Edwards, who is just an absolute delight. Great guy and wonderful with the media, totally understood the media's role, you know, treated us with a great deal of respect, gave us great access. He let us watch, believe it or not, he let us watch all of practice, which just is not done in the NFL anymore. Like you could watch practice every day, every minute of it if you wanted. And I always say this, that like when things started to sour between Herm and the Jets, like the reporters, I think, were much more on Herm's side. You know, like that's just the reality because we had a relationship with him. He treated us well. You know, we thought he knew what he was doing.
Is that an indictment of us? Is that at all an indictment of us?
I think it's just human. I mean, you know, I think like, is there any business where you treat, if you're treated poorly, where, you know, you're not going to react? No. I mean, not to say that we weren't critical of Herm. We were, you know, like Herm himself might admit that he still, you know, he couldn't manage the clock, you know, like that was a running theme. And so, you know, we would say like, we would be critical of that. We were critical, but I think it's harder to like the sort of over the top mean-spirited critique. That's much harder to do.
But I'm interested in something. I didn't see myself asking this question, but you covered those Jets, and they had an ancient but still effective Vinny Testaverde playing quarterback.
Yes.
And they had a young and green Chad Pennington at quarterback.
Yes.
And I wonder, from a journalist standpoint, are you better served media-wise with the savvy veteran who's been through the drill a million times and knows how to manipulate things a little bit? Mm-hmm. Or maybe the young, green, not savvy, Marshall University, you know, West Virginia kid. What is better for you?
Well, this is probably not the best example for that question because they were both terrific with the media. Like Chad was great at it, you know, very smart guy and was really good. Even when he would get annoyed with us, he was good. And Vinny was, you know, very good, as you would expect for somebody who'd at that point been in the league, however many years it had been. They were both terrific. Generally, what do I think is better? It probably just depends on the individual. I mean, and I'm not sure that there's even young green quarterbacks in particular, because I think quarterbacks get so much training in college now to be that guy, right? Like Joe Burrow, now obviously he went to a huge college program where I'm sure they do plenty of media training. He's used to having the cameras on him and the microphone. But like, I'm completely impressed with how sophisticated he is with the media and how good he is with the media. And I don't even know if you get the sort of green young quarterback anymore, because I just think the system, the college system now, is so good at prepping those guys who are clearly going to have a future in the NFL. They get them ready in all respects. And that's a big one.
Wouldn't you rather deal with the rookie free agent halfback from Delaware State than the polished seasoned LSU quarterback?
Yes, because he's probably got an interesting backstory, right? Except the reality of the situation is, yes, as a reporter, you want the sort of offbeat, like, what's the deal here? Why are you still doing this kind of story? But the reality of the situation is, goes back to, like, what's the audience care about? Like, the audience cares a lot more about Joe Burrow.
Right.
Way more.
Right.
Dave Anderson, the late, great Dave Anderson, who I was so lucky to work with, you know, his famous line was, when in doubt, write the quarterback. Like, if you're out of training camp on day 17 and you cannot come up with a story, just write the quarterback. Like, it's fine.
I'm going to ask you one more Jet-related question. You had Wayne Corbett, obviously, recovering Wayne Corbett, very good Jet wide receiver. And I'm always fascinated by people who cover football for a long portion of their career. Like, here's Wayne Corbett, and you covered him when he was a really good, very popular Jet wide receiver. He has since, in retirement, talked outwardly about his concussion problems and sort of real struggles, you know, life struggles. Is it hard? I don't know. Is it hard writing about a sport? Do you ever sort of look at yourself and your career and think, these people are beating the shit out of themselves, and a lot of these people are going to walk away from this game in really bad shape? Do you ever sort of think to yourself, should we even be covering this? Is this even a thing to be celebrating? Is it okay to get excited about Sundays and blah, 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 when 10 years from now, some of these people may not remember their names? You know, does that go through your head?
No. And I covered Wayne, and I remember a game where he was knocked out and then returned to the game, which was something that was done at the time, which now seems like right, insane. I don't think about it as much now, because I feel like the guys who are entering, who are in the league now, are well aware of the risks, right? I mean, there can't be anybody playing football now who does not know the concussion risks and the other, you know, the other injury risks for that matter. So I don't struggle with that part of it. I hate those stories. I mean, they're terrible. It's horrendous. And certainly when Wayne has talked about it, and it's awful, because I remember him at the height of his career, and it's, so it's painful. But I don't, you know, I don't like hold myself responsible for that. Like, the reality of the situation is these guys are doing it because they want to do it. And one thing and when you report on these guys is, like, you ask them, like, why don't you stop? And they don't want to stop. Like, they have fully embraced the risk that to those of us on the outside think, like, this, you're crazy. Like, what are you doing? Even after they've come back from injuries, you're just like, why would you keep doing this? It's because they love it, and this is what they want to do, and they're making their choice. I don't feel, I don't feel guilty about covering football.
You spent 15 years at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the NFL Network. And I wonder, when you make that jump and you work at, you know, arguably the greatest newspaper, if not in the world, certainly in the United States, and you go to the NFL Network, are there assurances you need at the time? I'm not a mouthpiece for the NFL, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm a reporter and you will let me report this fully. Do you have to go through that before you accept that position?
Yeah, I asked a lot of people that question, including people who worked for teams, you know, like, how do you treat the NFL Network? Like, what do you expect? I mean, yes, I asked that question of all kinds of people. Yeah, no question about it. And it hasn't, to my surprise, it has not been an issue for me.
Well, you wrote, I was leading to, you wrote something July 13th, 2020, fucking so ridiculously good. Like, ridiculously good. It was Washington team name change and longstanding embarrassment for NFL. And what I liked about, first of all, is if I were the NFL, I would hate this story. Like, I would hate this piece. Like, it's like, I just want to read a little. I just read for a second here. For more than a month and 4 years after Colin Kaepernick ignited a firestorm by kneeling to protest police brutality, the NFL has moved to position itself as a leader for societal change. It declared that Black Lives Matter. It pledged $250 million to social justice initiatives. It admitted it should have listened sooner to its own players. Changes came to the NFL gradually. Then suddenly, in the wake of George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police officers who were later charged with Floyd's murder. And on Monday, a move that was inconceivable a little more than 2 weeks ago became reality. Washington will have a new name, erasing the blight of the one that was so offensive, commentators will call games without once using it. It would have been impossible to take entirely seriously the NFL's full-throated embrace of the fight against racism if one of its team's names was, in fact, a racial slur. You go on, it's ridiculously good. It's as good an essay as I read about the changing of the team name. And sort of wondering, like, you sit down to write this. Is there any thought the NFL may not like this? Or is the thought just, to hell with it? This is how I feel. This is what I'm putting down. This is what I'm writing.
Yeah, I obviously you're conscious of the idea that, like, there may be people who really hate this. My feeling is always like my editors will probably protect me from myself, right? So I'm going to write what I want to write. I wrote what I wanted to write about Ray Rice, you know, that disaster. And I figure if the editors are like, you're going too far, like you're being ridiculous, they would tell me. Having said that, I also know that there's plenty of people in the NFL who hated the Washington name too. So I was on pretty solid ground there. There were plenty of people who were uncomfortable with it. But it's never been an issue. Like, I've never gotten a call from somebody in the league office, like, letting me have it about something I wrote or something I said on the air. I think that's probably part of the bargain, that when they made the decision that they were going to hire, like, real reporters for the NFL Network, that they probably were like, well, you know, like, if you're going to hire Judy, she's probably not going to agree with everything that happens in the NFL, and she's likely to say it. The Washington name isn't, that's an easy one. Like, you're not getting any pushback from anybody on that.
Right. You, in regards to Ray Rice, who I just want to say, from my adopted hometown of New Rochelle, New York. So we always, Ray Rice and I, you wrote in 2014, you wrote, the painful truth has haunted the NFL since the firestorm following the investigation into Rice's incident. The NFL knew plenty, certainly enough, to get it right the first time. But the NFL relied heavily on the judicial outcome of Rice's case and on precedent that was inadequate, not just for current moves, but for common sense in a league that has held itself up as a moral arbiter. I mean, again, like, you didn't take any, there was definitely no precaution here. No, like, oh, my employer might be mad, but worried about this. Were you just, did Ray Rice just piss you off? Like, were you just mad?
Yes, right. I was mad. I was mad and disappointed in people. Like, I was you know, like, I obviously have covered these people for years, people, and I was just disappointed. Like, how could you think this was handled well? Come on. And, like, these people are really smart. Like, I hate when people say, like, you know, the NFL hates women. The NFL doesn't hate women. I mean, these people don't hate women. But, like, I was like, how could you think that this was good? You know it was wrong. And, you know, they since have sort of admitted in retrospect, like, yeah, we, you know, obviously didn't handle that right the first go around. And they learned, you know, they've learned a lot. And I think even Roger Goodell has said it publicly, like, you know, he learned a lot, right? Like, he didn't really know anything about domestic violence. It wasn't really part of his universe. And of course, then he did a lot of research and found out it's part of everybody's universe. And, you know, they had to have a better response. Especially on those things that, like, where I'm just angry, like, then I really don't hold back at all. And again, I feel like my editors will probably save me from myself if I, you know, have gone too far. Right. I've never considered myself a flamethrower, though. Like, that's not my thing. Like, I try to be reasoned and I try to consider what they might be thinking. I understood the, we want to rely on the judicial system, except the judicial system fails domestic violence cases, you know, right? They fail women. They have historically failed women in domestic violence cases. So relying on them is not the right way to go. Like, you have to use your own judgment. And, you know, so, but I try to let them say what they want to say and explain themselves and give them a chance. That's just not exclusive to the NFL. I mean, that's sort of how I was taught to report. You know, but there are just some cases where, you know, you're just like, what are you doing? You know, what are we doing here?
I think it's interesting. You say you're not a flamethrower, and you're definitely not a flamethrower. I think one thing we've lost in this era of social media, and I think you feel similarly as I do about social media, that it's this necessary evil and we get kind of sucked into it, but it fucking sucks.
I often say that whenever I retire, like, the first thing I will do.
Oh my God.
Like, the first thing.
I'm there with you. We'll see who retires first. And we're making this bond right now, Judy. We will get rid of it. Yes. I don't want it. I hate it. But I'm always looking at it.
Yes. I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, it sucks. But I was thinking how one of the problems with Twitter and social media is people throw so many flames that there's no impact whatsoever. And one of the things, so when Judy Batista sort of lambasts, you know, Daniel Snyder, the formerly Redskins for this name, or lambasts the NFL about Ray Rice, it carries a million times more oomph because you're not someone who's screaming every day, this sucks, this is awful, this is hell. I just think we've lost that a little bit. We scream so much that nuance has been killed.
Well, I think nuance has been killed in every form, not just on social media. I mean, nuance has been lost in a lot of columns. I mean, there's no attempt to sort of imagine what the decision makers are thinking. You know, like, why would you make that choice? Maybe it's the totally wrong choice, but like, what are you thinking? Like, what's going on? I feel like we've all, and not exclusive to sports, universally, like, we have lost the patience to like try to understand what the other person is doing. You know, we just completely have lost that because we're supposed to have a reaction like this to everything. So
this is what I think you actually nailed it perfectly. Like, we've gotten to a point where the NFL does something, Ray Rice happens, and we go, the NFL hates women. Like, this happens, and we go from here to here. And it's like, what a good reporter would do is actually find out Roger Goodell's background with women, find out these owners' background with women. Maybe they just don't understand women, or maybe something happened. But we always now just make that jump from here to there, and it's ruinous.
It's ruinous. And I think a part of it is also, you know, we are more and more distant, especially in sports, as sports journalism has proliferated. There's so many more outlets and so that people don't have relationships with the people they cover anymore. Like, you know, there are so many people who cover the NFL now who I'm sure have never sat down and talked to Roger Goodell casually. Right. You know, they've certainly never sat down and had dinner with him where you find out about his family and, you know, what he cares about. And I'm lucky enough that I've done that. And so I feel like, you know, when you do that with people you cover, like, you, that gives you at least a little insight into what they're thinking, which is not to say that they don't get stuff wrong, because we all do. Right. Certainly I've been wrong in some of the things I've written, but, you know, at least you're making an attempt to understand what the motivation is.
Right. I agree. I have a final question for you. So if you go back 21 years, you and I undoubtedly were on the same baseball field at Shea Stadium watching the Mets and the Braves play. And if you took a picture of all the reporters there that day, you and I are probably two of maybe, let's say there were 40 reporters working that day, we're probably two of eight still in the business. You know, like, it's, you know what I mean? Though it's kind of faded and it's faded and it's faded. How do you survive in this business? Like, how do you actually survive in this business?
Well, I think you have to be nimble and you have to adjust. I mean, certainly I do more television now than I ever imagined I was going to do in my career. Mm-hmm. And that certainly has, you know, I think you've got to have multiple skills. And you've got to be willing to sort of roll with it if you want to stay in. Now, I also think there's some merit to just saying, like, you know what, like, this business is not for me anymore. Like, there's many of our colleagues in the business have gone to the PR side, and I don't blame anybody for doing that.
Remember when it used to be like, we'd be like, maybe you weren't like this. I definitely was when I was in college at Delaware. You'd be like, oh, the sellout went to PR. And now you're like, I get it, 100%.
I totally get it. The industry has changed so, and change is not even the word, right? It has blown up. It's just, it's insane. Never could have imagined that newspapers would be where they are right now in the dire straits they're in. And so I think you have to adapt. I mean, I still enjoy it. And so I certainly made the conscious decision to go to the NFL Network knowing that it was going to mean I'd be doing more TV and that kind of stuff than I, you know, whatever I've done at the New York Times, you know, and maybe less writing, even though like when I went to the NFL Network, I made it clear, like, I still really want to write because I still like to write. But I think you just have to be willing to adapt to the changing industry because it's clear the industry is going to keep evolving. I mean, I have no idea what the industry is going to look like in 10 years. That's for sure.
Will you be in it?
In 10 years. Let me do the math. I think I'll still be in it to some capacity. Yeah. I enjoy it. I still enjoy it. I think maybe I'll, you know, do, like, I'm envious of how you write books. I would love to do that. Do more of that. Like, but I think I'll be in it to some capacity. Yeah.
I'm envious how you get a paycheck every week or 2 weeks. So.
That's the trade-off, right?
Yeah, that's what it is.
I'm amazed at people who do both. Like, because yeah. I'm How do you manage that without losing your mind? But
I know. Well, I just want to say, Judy, you've really come a long way since Freshman Fats.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing that you found that. And you know, I'm going to immediately text like my friends from college right now and be like, you're not gonna believe this.
I want to thank today's guest, Judy Batista, for joining me on Two Riders Sling and Yang. You can follow Judy on Twitter at Judy Batista and read her work at NFL.com. One can listen to Two Riders Sling and Yang on pretty much every podcast medium, and reviews are always appreciated. My new book, Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty, drops September 22nd, but it's available for advanced purchase everywhere. Music is by the dazzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.